A couple of weeks ago, we started a series called Thin Places, Encountering God's Glory, really in response to what we sense God is doing amongst us, that, that again, this morning as we worship, there's just a sense of his presence, and there's just a sense that God is presencing himself amongst us. And so we're responding to that, and we've just responded with this series. And so we're just going through some scriptures and looking at moments of encounter where God's people encounter him, and how does God reveal himself, and how does it shape us, and what does that encounter look like, and what does it mean? And we've called this series Thin Places because, 1,500 years ago, those that brought Christianity to the UK, the Celtic saints, had names for these places that were thin places, where it felt like the barrier between heaven and earth was thinner. Like it was easier to connect with God, and that his presence just felt more tangible. And they're called thin places. And I was grappling with the question, what would it look like for us to be a thin-placed people? For the thin place not to just be a set location in a set time, but actually for us, as we encounter God, something shifts within us. And that actually the barrier between heaven and earth seems thin for us as we encounter God. That space feels thin. But then thin places also are places where people pilgrimage. Those that are hungry to encounter God will travel. I was saying a few weeks ago that I've been to Iona and traveled across to Lindisfarne, and there is something different about these spaces and places. And hungry people will pilgrimage. What would it happen if those that are hungry seeking God, maybe without even realizing it, that it's God that they're seeking, that when they are with us, they're encountering God? What does it look like to be a thin place people? Well, last time we looked at Exodus 33, where Moses has this encounter with God, and he says, "Show me your glory." And we explored that actually as God reveals his glory, that his glory is revealed through his goodness, his mercy, and his compassion. And there's something of the reality of who God is when we experience his goodness, his mercy, and his compassion. Well, we're going to stay in Moses' life this morning, but we're going to go back in time. So we're going to go back to the beginning of Exodus, Exodus chapter 3. So if you've got a Bible, Exodus chapter 3. You'll be familiar with this passage, I'm sure. If you've grown up in church, you'll have done fuzzy felts probably when you were a kid in Sunday school. They don't do those anymore. It's all digital videos. But in my day, it was fuzzy felts. And so I knew this story as made out of felt. You'll be familiar with this story. But while you're finding Exodus chapter 3, let me just give you a bit of a background. That at the end of Genesis, the life for the people of God is going well. So there's been a famine in the land, and Joseph, the guy with the nice coat, he has kind of been gone from being in the prison to the palace, and he's leading the people through this famine, and he's been given a place of influence, and he's stewarding that, and his family come to live with him, and people of God, the Hebrews, they are doing well, they're flourishing. Now, time passes, and at the beginning of Exodus, what we see is that there's a new Pharaoh in the land who doesn't remember Joseph, doesn't remember all that he'd done. And so this Pharaoh is clearly struggling with a bit of insecurity, and he sees the Hebrew people, and he sees that they're increasing in number, and he's threatened by it. He's threatened by saying, what happens if these people rise up and try and overpower us? And so he decides that in an attempt to try and squash the growth of the Hebrew people, they're enslaved. And at the time of Moses' birth, what we see is that the Pharaoh decides that to cut back this Hebrew growing of the people, they're going to kill the boys that are born. And so Moses is born into this moment of genocide, this moment of infanticide where children are being killed to stop the growth of the Hebrew people. And so Moses' mom puts him in a basket and sends him down the river. And bizarrely, in a way that only God could manage, Moses rocks up at the feet of the palace where Pharaoh's daughter is bathing. And so she takes him out of the water and she names him Moses, which actually means to be brought out. And there's something in that moment of naming where it reveals his identity of who he is. He's being brought out of the water, but also confirms his destiny that he's going to be someone who will bring the people of God out of slavery. And so there's this bringing out in this moment. Moses is brought up in the Egyptian palace, but he's still a Hebrew boy. He's still, as he grows, he still knows that he has that as his identity. And so one day he's walking through the town and he sees one of his Hebrew brothers being beaten up by an Egyptian slave master, and his anger overtakes him. We see this with Moses. He has an issue with anger. You know, he smashes the tablets. He can get angry, and yet God still uses him. So don't let your frustrations and your anger think that it disqualifies you from being used by God. So in this moment, Moses gets angry, and he actually kills this Egyptian slave master, buries him, but he's seen doing it. And so Moses then has to flee. And he flees to the back and beyond of nowhere, to a place called Midian, because he's been caught out. And so he arrives in Midian, and I'm trying to remember the story. So he ends up at Midian, and he comes to this well, I think it is. And there's the high priest, Jethro. His daughters are getting water, and they're going to be scared away from some shepherds. So Moses steps in and defends these daughters of the high priest. And so the high priest, to thank him, I mean, this is a gift. The high priest says, "Thank you very much. Here's one of my daughters." And so he marries one of the high priest's daughters. So if you're ever thinking of what's an appropriate gift to get to say thank you to somebody, if you've got a daughter, it's biblical. No, that's not. I'm not promoting that. Just thinking how my daughter would take that. So he gives one of his daughters, and Moses marries this daughter, and he spends 40 years in this wilderness place, Midian, married to one of the high priest's daughters. And that's when we have this moment where Moses encounters who I think is Jesus. You know, I think these physical representations of God in the Old Testament, it's Jesus that he's experiencing. And so he has this moment of encounter with God's glory. And let me read it to you. I'm going to read quite a few verses. It will come up on the screen if you've not got a Bible, but I'm hoping I've got the same translation. No, I don't. Can I pinch your CSB? I've got ESV, just in case. Oh, my words, how do you read that? That is a small print, isn't it? Great difficulty. Exodus 3, here we go. "Meanwhile, Moses was shepherding the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led the flock to the far side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God." That's also called Sinai, okay? Same place. So it's the place of encounter. It's the place where God reveals himself. "Then the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire within a bush. As Moses looked, he saw that the bush was on fire but was not consumed. So Moses thought, 'I must go over and look at this remarkable sight. Why isn't the bush burning up?'" I love the Bible. Just the inner monologue. So Moses is writing this, and he's kind of speaking to it. Do you ever speak to yourself? Moses going, "Oh, look." Sorry, that just tickles me. Obviously nobody else. "When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called out to him from the bush, 'Moses, Moses.'" Acknowledge that. "It wasn't until he stopped and moved towards that the voice of God then speaks to him. 'Here I am,' he answered. 'Do not come any closer,' he said. 'Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place where you're standing is holy ground.' Then he continued, 'I am the Lord God of your father, of God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob.' Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, 'I have observed the misery of my people in Egypt, and I have heard them crying out because of their oppressors. I know about their suffering, and I have come down to rescue them from the power of the Egyptians and to bring them from the land, from that land to a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the territory of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, the Parasites, the Mosquito Bites.'" Just checking you're listening. "So because the Israelites' cry for help has come to me, and I have also seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them, therefore go, I am sending you to Pharaoh so that you may lead my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt.' But Moses asked God, 'Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the Israelites out of Egypt?' He answered, 'I will certainly be with you. And this will be the sign to you that I am the one who sent you. When you bring the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain.'" What a beautiful thing that we're, the picture of what God does, that actually he's calling his people out of slavery to a place of freedom. And that place of freedom is a place of worship, a place of acknowledging who God is. "Then Moses asked God, 'If I go to the Israelites and say to them, your God, the God of your father has sent me, and they ask me, what is his name? What should I tell them?' God replied to Moses, 'I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you.' God also said to Moses, 'Say this to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever. This is how I am to be remembered in every generation.'" What an amazing story. I want to ask you a few questions this morning. Not to get into groups, we won't do that this morning, but sort of questions for you just to ponder, questions for you to think about. And the first question I want to ask you this morning is this. It's a really simple question. I think you'll be able to answer it in a matter of seconds. It's not a difficult question. But the question is this: who is God? Who is God? And the follow-up question that I want to ask you to that is, who is God and what is he like? Who is God and what is he like? I've got an audio that hopefully will work. So I'm just going to play this little sort of vox pop thing that people asked that question.
What do you think God is?
I don't know, more of just a belief, an idea of something greater.
A supreme being.
I don't pray to a God, I pray there is one.
You know, like faith and stuff.
God is energy that is in all of us.
Everything around us right now.
God is great, I guess.
God is drugs.
I just feel like he protects everyone pretty much.
I think it's a story.
I think he's religion, he's life, but I think it's a lot of other things. I have mixed feelings about God.
God is a comforting delusion.
I do not believe in God, so I don't think about him at all.
God is creator.
When you look up in the night sky, you know that you're not alone.
I know that I believe that there's somebody watching over.
God's one of those figures that people kind of look for hope.
God is people's reason for things they themselves can't explain.
So they interviewed some people and asked, who is God? I love that it's got nice chill jazz music. And God's a delusion. Da, 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 da. That made me chuckle. But there's so many different answers to that question, if it's based on our perception, on our understanding. Who is God? And I suspect if I ask everyone in this room who is God, broadly speaking, I suspect we'll come with similar answers, because I'm going to make a guess that the majority of people in the room have some kind of belief or exploring the reality of who God is, because this is a church. And so some of you will hold to that and will read scripture and base your view on who God is from that. Others will kind of go, I think this maybe is who God is. And so broadly speaking, we have an idea that there is a God. But I suspect that our responses to that question will be nuanced. There's differences because we've been brought up in different ways. We have different hopes and different fears and different desires, things that can shape that question when we're asked, who is God? And we bring those experiences and we bring those desires and we bring those hopes to the reality of what we perceive God to be. We're calling this series Thin Places, Encounters with Glory, because it's about encountering God. And like Moses in this passage, one thing I want to say about our encountering with God and who God is this: God and God alone gets to define who he is. We so often, and let's not just think it's the world, and you know, some of those people might have been Christians, they may not, but as the church, so often we can bring our assumption of who God is. And God says in this passage, he says, I am who I am. And we're going to explore this passage, but God alone is the one that gets to define the reality of who he is. Let's not think that we can be comfortable in our view of God. We might sit much more comfortably with the idea that God is love, God is grace, God is mercy, the stuff we looked at last time. Oh, it's so nice to think that God is good, God is merciful, God is full of compassion, and he is. But his judgment, his sovereignty, his standard of living for those who follow his ways, maybe we're not so comfortable with that. So we want to adjust our view of who God is. Maybe we agree with the grace of God until it means living alongside someone we disagree with or someone we struggle with. And then we start to define God based on, as Timothy Keller would say, so often we base our view of God on an idealized version of ourself. God votes the same way I do. He's got the same views I do. They're just better than mine. And we need to be really careful. God alone is the one who gets to define who he is. I am who I am, God says. And so I think there's some things that I just want to draw out from this passage to begin with about the reality of who God is and how he reveals himself. Yes, he is the God of goodness, mercy, and compassion that we saw last week. But I think there's something of this passage that reminds us as we encounter God, who is the God that we're encountering? And my first point is this, that the God we encounter is a God who is above us. He is completely other. He is completely distinct. He is not just an idealized version of us with better views and a little bit more tolerant or a little bit more compassionate. He is completely other. He is transcendent, theologians would call it. He is above and beyond anything we can grasp within our own human minds and needs and experiences. Verse 1, Moses is looking after his father-in-law's flock of sheep, and he ends up in the wilderness near Mount Horeb. And it's the mountain of encounter, and here he sees this bush that's on fire. And verse 2, it says, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire within a bush. As Moses looked, he saw that the bush was on fire but was not consumed. I love fire. Not in like a weird pyromaniac kind of set things on light kind of way. I like fire because I'm blessed to have a log burner in my lounge, and there is nothing better on a cold day than just lighting a fire. And whether you agree with this or not, I'll have a little glass of wine and I'll read my book. And there is something about just that space, just being in that and watch. I could watch the fire and just watch the flames. Something about fire draws us to it, doesn't it? And we're drawn towards that fire. It draws us in. But what we also see about fire is that we intrinsically keep a distance from it. I will get so close to that fire, but I'm not going to get so close that it burns me. Because there's something about fire that is dangerous. There's something about fire that you keep away from. We keep our distance. I remember when I was burning some stuff in my garden, when I moved in, there was like this outhouse, big long kind of shed thing that was falling over. So we piled it up in the garden, we knocked it all down, piled it up in the garden and lit a fire. It was so hot. It was so hot, in fact, my mum was helping. And at the end of the evening, she was wearing a gold necklace and it left like a suntan of where her necklace had been. You know, she was slightly burnt, and where the necklace had been was still white flesh. And so fire can be dangerous, so we keep our distance. But this fire draws Moses closer. Moses, Moses, God calls out to him. And he says, here am I. But then in verse 5, do not come any closer. He said, remove the sandals from your feet, for the place where you're standing is holy ground. Draw close, but keep a distance. Because why? God is above us all. And so Moses takes the sandals off his feet. Why? Well, it says because this is holy ground. How is it holy? Is it because it's some special location on earth, especially holy because so God can show up there? No, I think the reality is that it's holy not in order for God to show up. It's holy because God has shown up. And this is holy ground because the presence of God makes it holy. That word holy means distinct, set apart. The God that we come and worship is a holy God. And this is why Moses hides his face. He hides his face in fear of God. So that voice that draws Moses closest to him is the one that also causes him to hide in reverent fear. See, the reality of God is there's a friendship and a fear. And I will always lean towards the friendship of God. It's the way I'm kind of wired, I think. I like to lean towards that side, probably to the expense of the fear of God. But there's something about going, do you know what? It's both and. It's not either or. There is a revealing of the reality of who God is in his friendship and his fear. Through Jesus, as Ian read from Hebrews, in Jesus we have the doors are wide open for us to enter in with confidence and boldness, but not flippantly. Not like he's our best mate, although he is our friend. And I think sometimes, you know, I grew up in the Anglican church, and it was a charismatic Anglican church, but there were traditions when you came in some of the services. And I, at the time when I was a kid, I was like, oh, this is so boring. But actually now as I go into those moments, there's something of a reminder of the reality of the God that I'm coming to worship. That there is a reverence. And I think as God's people, we need to be careful that we don't come into his presence flippantly. Because of how we do things. Because he is openly available and his grace is sufficient. Absolutely. But he is a holy God. He is sovereign. And so when we get the great worship leaders leading us here into the presence of God who are gifted, we come and we go, do you know what, God? You are holy. And I need to be reminded that these doors are wide open and I am accepted and loved, but you are holy. God, you are completely other. You are completely above us. We need to be careful we don't take lightly the truth of who God is and reduce him to a being that is manageable and containable. As we encounter God's presence in this place, it may not be controllable and it may not be manageable. That's not to say it's necessarily going to be wild and crazy and out there. But God can do what God wants to do because God is who he says he is, not what me or Ian or the elders or anyone else in this church wants to define him as. He is who he is, and he will do what he wants to do because that is who he is. And so as we encounter him, we encounter the God who is above us. Think of the rest of this story. God is a God who will do what he wants to do. And he makes some promises to Moses in this passage, doesn't he? Go to Pharaoh and set my people free. And what we then see as we journey on in this story is that Moses goes against Pharaoh, the most powerful man in the land. And he goes to see the people of God set free, but Pharaoh refuses. And there is a battle of will and a battle of power, but God makes it happen. God has the power to keep the promises that he has made. And some of us, we live in a world where we're like, this is a rubbish illustration, but it's the best I can come up with. We're in a car journeying along in our life. And you can see ahead of you, but there's like a bend. And you're like, I can't see beyond that. All I can see is that which is in front of me. And even that's a bit blurry. And you can look in your rearview mirror and you're like, there's carnage behind. There's some nice bits. I remember that little bit. That was a nice bit. And then there's that. Oh, man, I wish I hadn't had that crash right there. And you can see behind you and you can only see a little bit in front of you. And that's how we define our life. And that's how we think God is part of keeping his promises. It's like, oh, man, I'm not sure about it. I don't know if God, but God is above us. It's like he's in the helicopter looking down. I can see way back further than you can. And I can see way beyond the bend that you can. And I've made some promises and you need to hold on to them because I've got the power to bring those promises into fruition. I'm preaching better than you're responding. So I say, I'm preaching to myself. So I thought my illustration is like, wow, he can see around the bend because I'm going around the bend. But that's who he is. And he has the power to keep his promises. And that's what we see in this passage. He is above us. And as his people, we need to remember that. As we come and encounter his presence as we're gathered, but as we go out when we're scattered, he is above us. He holds it all together. That is who he is. I think the second thing that we see from these passages is that God is above us, but God is also among us. God is among us. Verse 7 says, "The Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and I have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their suffering." God is above us, but he is among us. He is among us in spite of ourselves. If you read Exodus chapter 1 and 2, what you may notice as you dive into those scriptures is that the Israelites have multiplied and they've become enslaved, but the name of God is very rarely mentioned in chapter 1 and 2. Very rarely mentioned. In fact, chapter 2, 23, it says the cry of the people of God was heard by God, but interestingly, it doesn't say that they directed their cry to God. It just says they were crying out and God heard their cry. And God steps in. He sees, he hears, and he steps in. Even to a people who are suffering, who have forgotten that the reality of their experience has blinded them from the God who keeps his promises, and they're not crying out to him, he still hears because he is faithful and he is among them. And in verse 8 of Exodus 3, it says, "I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, to bring them out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey." God is not absent. He is above us, but he is among us. So as we gather as God's people, we do so with awe and respect of a holy God, who he alone is worthy to receive all glory, honor, and power, regardless of how we feel, no matter what we've got going on. We make a choice to say, I declare the reality of who you are, and we come in holy awe of who you are. I stand in awe, as we sang this morning. But we can also know the full assurance that he is a God that longs to be experienced and encountered. That he has been with us and continues to be with us, that he has rolled up his sleeves and he gets stuck into the story of people's lives and he's going to rescue his people. That's the promise. That he rescued his people back in Exodus and he can rescue his people through Christ in the New Testament and we who are part of God's people now, he will rescue us and he is among us. Maybe you feel forgotten by God. Maybe the moments that we experience can be so tempting to define our God by our experiences rather than letting God define our experiences. And we need to be reminded who he is. God says, I have seen, I have heard, I am concerned. And that is how God chooses to reveal his glory in this passage. As a God who is above us, but a God who is among us. It's John chapter 1. It's John chapter 1 that says, revealing about Jesus, in the beginning was with God, all things were made through him, and without him not anything made that was made. In him was life, and life was the light of men, and the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. He is above it all. Jesus is above it all. But then go down to verse 14, and it says, and the word became flesh, and what? Dwelt among us. He tabernacled amongst us. That place of the reality of God's presence that was seen in the Old Testament, the tabernacle. He has dwelt amongst us. That's the promise. And we have seen his glory. Wow. If we could just grasp what that verse means. We've seen his glory. The one, Moses, the one who hid his face from God's glory through Jesus, we have now seen his glory, can encounter his glory and get invited to step into his glory. Glory of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness, that's John the Baptist, bore witness about him and cried out, this was he whom I said, he who comes after me ranks before me because he was before me. Church, I want to say this, and if you don't take notes and you've just got a really good memory, remember this thing if nothing else. Church, we will only appreciate the amongness of God if we are first in awe of the aboveness of God. We will only appreciate when we gather, which are important moments as God Church. Jesus gathered with the followers of God each week in the synagogue. So us gathering is not something that we're against. And he moves as his people gather. But we will only appreciate what he's doing amongst us when we are in awe of who he is. That he, the God that created all things, is going to dwell amongst us and presence himself with us. When our hearts are captivated by who he is, we will be blown away when he draws near. And those encounters with his glory will increase and increase. And actually what happens in those moments, what we see from John the Baptist in John chapter 1, is that there's a transformation that comes. John's life was identified by the encounter he'd had with Jesus. Here's one who comes before me, whose ranks, and I'm going to give my life. I know my identity now. It's calling out in the wilderness, prepare the way for the one. And what we see in Moses with this Exodus 3 encounter, this moment changes the course of Moses' life. Because what we see in this passage, and another question I want to ask you is, what we see is that God is above us. What we see of the reality of who God is God is amongst us. But something happens, and the natural response when we encounter God, and this is what I think these spaces are about. Yes, they're about us being together, glorifying God, worshiping him, having an encounter with him, and having an encounter with him in such a degree that our response is, if that's who you are, God, then who am I? And if we have a real encounter with the reality of who God is, it should cause us to say, well, in light of that, who am I? Who am I and how should I be living? Because it should transform how we live our life and how we define ourselves. Who am I? So much of society will define itself and try to ask the question, who am I? See, a century ago, our definition of identity was probably marked by your growing up, by your parents. Majority of people would do the job their parents did. They would live in the place that their parents lived. But now you can invent yourself and reinvent yourself on the daily basis. You can be whoever you want to be. We switch careers. I'm not knocking this. You can switch careers at the drop of a hat. You can move around. You can have online identities, whatever that means. Identity has become fluid. You can identify in any way you want to. You can be whoever you want to be. It's like the world is a world of opportunity. But in that, actually what gets created is depression and anxiety. That's what we're seeing. That in this freedom to be whoever we want to be, what correlates to that is an increase in depression and anxiety. And there's studies that are linking the two things. Because now, my identity is down to me. My identity is down to me. And if I want to become something, if I want to achieve something, then it's down to me. But biblically speaking, our identity is not something that is achieved, it is something that is received. That is the reality of identity. If we look at Jesus before he's done anything recorded in Scripture, what do we see? We see that at his baptism, the Father says, "This is my Son in whom I am well pleased." There's his identity and there's the affirmation of the Father over him. "You are my Son and I am pleased with you. Before you've done anything, I am pleased with you." And there's the receiving of an identity, the voice of the Father over the Son. And it is confirmation of identity and destiny. For Moses, he questions his identity in this moment. Who am I? I think it's verse 11 maybe. Who am I to go before Pharaoh? You put this task before me and it is so much bigger than I could possibly imagine. I think it's the same for us today. We might enjoy creating our own identity until we find ourselves unable to deliver on it. And for so many, the pressure to achieve and sustain a self-built identity simply becomes too much because it's not how we were created. And we see cracks in that identity. And we see cracks in trying to live up to that person. And those cracks become wider and exposed. And we can't hold it all together. And so we spend our life evaluating and re-evaluating our identity, striving to conform, dealing with the failures to live up with it. The question is, who are you? That's where Moses is at. I've had an encounter with God and it's deeply causing me to question who I am. Society does not need the answers. It needs an encounter with God. Because when we encounter God, we naturally go, who am I? And God will answer. And we see God answer in verse 12. And how does he answer? Good old classic God way. I'll be with you. God never seems to answer that question. He just confirms the reality of his presence. God is saying to Moses that his identity is tied up in God's activity. Who I am, my presence. Moses says, who am I that I should go before Pharaoh? And we might turn around and say, actually, Moses, you're the ideal person to go up against Pharaoh. You're a Hebrew man that was brought up in Pharaoh's palace. You know both cultures. You know both people. You know what it is to be the person forgotten in the back and beyond of nowhere. But you also know the reality of protecting a flock. And so you should know what it is to want to protect God's people. You know what the Egyptians are like. You know what the Hebrews are like. You're the perfect person to go. But God doesn't say that. God doesn't give him the pep talk. God simply says, I am with you. God is the one who makes the difference, who shapes Moses' identity and forms his destiny. That's the invitation as we encounter God, not just to experience the reality of who God is, his aboveness and his amongness, but actually for us to be transformed and changed in that moment of encounter. See, Moses doesn't need a higher self-esteem in this moment. He needs a greater sense of God's presence. He needs an encounter with glory. And it's the presence of God that makes all the difference. If you think about it so far in Moses' story, he has tried to do it in his own strength. And what's happened? In his own strength, he sees one of his fellow Israelites being beaten up by a slave master. In his own strength, it ends up in murder. In his own strength, it ends up in him hiding a body. In his own strength, it ends up in him running for his life. In his own strength, he ends up in the back and beyond of nowhere. We can try to make it on our own. We can try to be a self-made person, and it may work for a while. We enjoy the autonomy. Society may be reveling in the gift of being able to be whoever it wants to be, but it cannot sustain it. It is not something that we are created to sustain. Whether we're trying to fit in at school and prove ourselves, whether we're trying to make it in our career or keep up with the Joneses, eventually the cracks will appear. And God says to his people, I am with you. My presence is with you. You can walk through this life with me. You can find your confidence and your worth in knowing that I am here. I am present. I am with you. You can know that in your achievements or your failures, nothing changes the reality of the fact that I am above you. I am among you. I am with you. And this encounter with glory that we are exploring is not just a Sunday possibility, but a daily lived reality. That's the invitation of an encounter with God's glory. And this is what it looks like to be a thin-placed people. Moses was one man in one place encountering God on behalf of a nation. We are now all people in all places filled with God for the sake of the nations. There is a defining of our identity and our destiny as we encounter the glory of God. Alan, will you come up and play? We're going to take communion. But one thing that strikes me about this passage, just as I draw things to a close, is that at the beginning I said that Moses sees this burning bush, which actually scholars would say that that is nothing unusual for Moses to encounter, that he is in a desert and he's looking after sheep. It's hot. Stuff will spontaneously just catch on fire. It's not the fact that the bush was burning. It's the fact that it was not being consumed. And he looks at it long enough to see that that bush is not being consumed. Oh, look, there's a bush on fire. No, no. What he does is, oh, there's a bush on fire. Oh, there's a bush on fire. Oh, hang on. That bush is on fire, but it's not being consumed. He stops and he pauses and he encounters in that moment something that catches his attention. But it's something that happened in his ordinary everyday life. That bush catching on fire, he would have seen multiple times. Encountering God's glory is not reserved for Sunday services. Yes, we want to see him presence himself as we lift him high, as we worship him. We want to see things happen as we gather, but it's not reserved for this space. There are moments in our ordinary everyday life where God is present and he is inviting us to notice. Burning bushes are those circumstances, those events that if we are willing will interrupt our life, but we have to give them attention. We have to stop long enough to inquire and go, God, maybe that is you. Maybe that person in our workplace that catches our attention. The events, the conversations, the words, the moments that are unplanned, unexpected, unforeseen. But there's something that demands a response from us. But we have a choice. We have a choice to just go, there's a burning bush, and carry on. Or we get to stop and go, there's a burning bush, I'm going to give some of my attention to it, because it feels like it's not being consumed. It feels like God might be there. And sometimes it's going to feel like, as we step towards that moment of encounter, that moment of a burning bush, that it's way beyond anything that we could do. How can I meet this person in their agony? I don't even know what words to say. How can I possibly understand what this person's gone through? But God's promise is, who are you? I'm with you. That's the promise of God. So what we see in this moment of encounter, is that Moses takes off his shoes. Are you willing? If you're willing, do you want to take off your shoes? Now, I'm not a feet person, so I don't want to see any hairy feet. But there's this moment for Moses where he takes off his shoes. Now, if you're not willing, actually, you really help my illustration even more, so you can keep your shoes on, that's fine. But there's something in this moment where Moses takes off his shoes. I don't know about you, but when I take my shoes off, certainly in a place like this, in a place that's unfamiliar, in a place like for Moses, there's rocks everywhere and it's the desert, and he takes his shoes off, I kind of go, man, I feel a little bit exposed. It feels a little bit uncomfortable. Like we can stub our feet. And I think, oh man, I've got white socks on and they're dirty already. But we feel vulnerable when we take our shoes off. Have you ever tried running barefoot down a road? You're like, whoa, stones, ah! It can be painful. We can feel exposed. People might see my wonky toes or the hole in my socks. It feels uncomfortable. Our shoes are like that moment of being able to say, I've defined myself. I'm self-sustaining, self-dependent. I can do it all. We cocoon ourselves in that place of safety, going, I've got it all manageable. And actually, we live in a town where risk is very low because everything's pretty manageable for the majority of people. Not struggling day to day. Life's pretty comfortable. And we've got our shoes on. But the invitation from God is to take your shoes off, to step in that place of depending on him, trusting in him. It flies against society that doesn't say, take your shoes off. It says, pull up your bootstraps. That's what society says. Pull up your bootstraps, get on with it. Come on, grin and bear it and get through it. God says, no, take your shoes off, encounter me. Live in that place of encountering glory. And as we gather, stepping into a place of worship, when we gather as a church, we get to take our shoes off week in, week out, vulnerably trusting him as we worship together. And as we live our life scattered, moving towards those people and places that capture our attention, that we're willing to allow to gather our thoughts and our attentions towards those burning bush people and places. Our response is, I take off my shoes and I trust you. Because it feels way beyond who I am. And that's the reality of encountering God's glory. So church, my prayer is that we would be a people that are so in awe of the aboveness of God that we increasingly desire his amongness. That in that place of encounter, we will linger long enough for it to shape our identity and call us out and change how we see the world around us so we can increasingly live as a thin-placed people. I think that's something of what God is doing amongst us.